Hey there, Mike.
Hey, man.
How are you, sir?
I'm very well. I'm very well.
So we've got back on the show after a long engagement at Harrah's Casino, where he opened five nights a week for Barry Manilow. We have Mr. Matt Bischoff, who is better, I think, known right now, at least, as the creator of QuoteBook, my favorite iOS app.
One of the three wonderful creators of QuoteBook.
Yeah, okay, one of the three wonderful creators of QuoteBook. But also, he's also doing some interesting things. I'm betting because he's an interesting guy. Are we allowed to say where you work now?
I think so. Yeah, I'm at the New York Times.
Congratulations!
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, the Gray Lady is lucky to have you, let me tell you.
Well, it's a lot of the same sort of stuff you're working on iOS things there.
Absolutely, yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah. Are you guys keeping an eye on what the Boston Globe just did with their responsive redesign?
Of course. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, okay, all right. Good. Yeah, they did great work, didn't they?
Yeah.
So first of all, how are things going?
Things are incredible. Things are absolutely great. And Pat, just so I don't get yelled at by somebody, the Boston Globe is actually a subsidiary of the New York Times. So that was us as well.
That gives me all new levels of hope.
I need to point people to the big web show. I'll give you the episode in a moment, Patrick.
Okay, sounds good.
On the big web show, they had one of the guys, it's episode number 57, a guy called Scott Gell, who did some work on the Boston Globe redesign, the responsive design, and it was a really interesting episode.
So that
should go in the show notes.
Noted. Yeah, anyone who hasn't seen that, you know, just point your browser, any browser, multiple browsers actually for full effect, at the
BostonGlobe.com,
and yep. Oh, jeepers, it is an HTML5 gasm, let me tell you.
Yeah, just resizing things is just is beautiful. It's like a native application.
It's really cool.
Fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, it's the way things should be done. I think in that kind of context. So, all I have to say is, you have a future subscriber in me. That's for sure.
Back to your question. Things are really great, and we're actually just finishing up some really exciting stuff for QuoteBook. So,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think both of you got that email, but
yes.
If you're listening and you're, you know, a QuoteBook user, you should definitely follow us on Twitter. So you can keep an eye out for that stuff.
For sure. Big things happening there.
Yep.
Good things happening there.
Mm.
So, one of the things I wanted to talk with you about, and this is something I've been thinking on recently a lot. And that is the idea that all software has a story.
Yeah.
And that I feel that story is told by the software's purpose, you know, how one expects this to be used, the features that are included. Here are some options we give you during that use, as well as the features that are left out. That in fact, even maybe the features that are left out tell more about tell more of a story than any other element in that. But that from these three things, you can infer kind of the story of this software, right? You can start to think, oh, I see why the developer made these choices or decided to create this app in the first place.
Right.
How much thinking do you do about that story, or is that something that only I think about because I'm crazy?
No, I think a lot of developers, especially developers who practice sort of agile development, which is a programming methodology or a set of programming methodologies, think about stories a lot. Because actually, in agile programming, there's this concept called the user story, which, according to Wikipedia, is a one or more sentence everyday business language of the end user that captures what the user wants to achieve. So you sort of, instead of like coming up with these, just screenshots or requirements, you come up with stories, and then you try and build the software to fulfill those stories. So this is something that's like really, I think, thought about by a lot of developers, especially the agile ones.
Okay. And is agile something that is that a methodology that you use in your development?
You know, it's something that, like, just like getting things done or any sort of methodology, you use parts of it. You know, I don't think I use all of getting things done. I don't think I use all of Agile, but I definitely lean much more towards Agile software development than Waterfall or any of the other methodologies that are pretty popular.
Okay. All right. And so, you know, because of that, you put a lot of thought and interest into coming up with that kind of one-line story, as it were.
Right, right. And I think that the one-line grand, the sort of grand vision elevator pitch story is definitely the most important. But then there are all of these other little moments, you know, these little, these sort of mini stories that happen in your software. Like, what does it feel like to import a file? Or what does it feel like to publish that picture to Facebook or whatever? And those are all, you know, those all have to serve the larger story. They're sort of like chapters in a book, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right.
Or scenes in a play, if you're more
well, yeah,
theatrical.
Well, and I think that in a way, that story is what draws the user in and gives them a personal connection to that software.
Right.
And so I guess that's the story of within the software of the usage and the, you know, and the features and the lack thereof. but I think that there's also another story that has always fascinated and interested me and I'm always drawn to. And I think anytime a software developer, you know, group of developers, whatever, put the story out there in a very plain way, that I'm even more likely to trust and use the software. Some examples we discussed before we started recording, but I want to reiterate them here. Pinboard, for instance. Pinboard is a, as they call themselves, an anti-social bookmarking service, which isn't entirely true because you certainly can share some bookmarks, but your bookmarks are private by default and you selectively turn things public based upon what you choose to share. For instance, that choice, that default can tell you a whole lot about the way that this was meant to be used and why it was created. While there are certainly other things like Delicious, you know, other things that are out there to use, and that's what sets it apart. That's how this is different and why it was created, at least in part.
Right.
And another good example that we brought up is Path, where, you know, you're limited to a group of 50 people that you can share things with in Path. And that 50 is derived from Dunbar's number. And it's an extrapolation of that where, you know, 50 is really your core group of closest friends. So because they've made that limitation a part of the software, basically remove the feature of being able to have as many share with as many people as you want, that in itself tells a story about the way that they expect you to share and the things that they expect you to share, or at the very least, the things you could share and be more comfortable with than you would in a much more public forum like Twitter or Facebook, and what separates it from something like that.
Right. I think there are a couple of other apps that I'd love to bring up that do this really well. Yeah. And one of them is an app called Kaleidoscope, which I know you've talked about before.
I love Kaleidoscope.
So do I. I use it every day.
Well, Michael's laughing because we just talked about it on the last episode. So.
Yeah, okay. So,
which you couldn't have heard, which is because we literally just recorded it. So I just thought
yeah. Okay. So one of the great things about Kaleidoscope that gets to this story model of software is that they do sort of a twist. They do some unexpected things in the software, which is like when it updates, it shows you the release notes inside of itself. Right? Which is amazing because if Kaleidoscope's telling the story of being the best app to view changes on something, and then it shows you its own changes in itself, it's delightful and surprising, and it's that moment in the narrative where you're like, oh, how could I have missed that, you know? And to see that in desktop software sort of blew me away. I was like, oh, man.
Beautiful example.
Yeah, and there are so many other ones. I mean, the blog littlebigdetails.com is a Tumblr that just captures these little story moments that I'm talking about. Where the developer sort of, as a storyteller, gives attention maybe to that one paragraph or that one page or one interface detail that most people will never see, but when they do see it, they're delighted. It's really inspiring. And, you know, for people who are software developers or designers, just reading that every day really gives you an idea of where you can bring that in.
Mm.
Some other ones, you know, sort of off the top of my head, renapp.com is a...
Oh, yeah, the little there. Twitter kind of client, yeah.
Which is a really simple app, which is not to say that it's simple to make, but it's a really simple app that just doesn't allow you to view tweets, just allows you to post them, but it also lets you save three drafts. And why three, right? You know, like, why can't
why not,
you
like, Birdhouse, where you can save a whole bunch?
Right, exactly. Because their whole story is that intentional tweeting, like, you know, thinking about it and not just making another place to pile things up, right? They want it to be beautiful and not a nag and not not annoying to have to go in and just see this huge pile of things that you thought were half good ideas.
Yeah.
And they do, you know, they do some subtle things on their website too, like they say, like, lovingly made for your Mac, like really communicating how much care they put into it, and it's a great app. You should definitely check it out.
Their promo video is incredible.
Yes, yeah. That's another thing. Promo videos, you know, after Adam Lissagor or Lonely Sandwich started putting out these great promo videos, I think everyone has really stepped up their game.
Yeah.
And it's just sort of playing off of each other, and the promo video space is really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Agreed. It's almost like the. It's become an increasingly popular trend for writers and book authors to basically do a book trailer.
Right.
And my favorites of these are really just the author themselves in, you know, some, you know, setting, an alleyway or a, you know, or a nice green field or something like that, telling the story of the book.
Yeah.
You know, you know, because there's a story that is beyond the story. There's, you know, there's the book, and the book gives you one story, but what's nice is sometimes these trailers reveal, oh, I see what this book is really about and what it means to them. And I think that's all part of it. I think far too often these stories are being told, and in general, they're subtle enough that we ignore them. Yet at the same time, we're being bombarded by them.
Right. Well, and it's really obvious when they're not there. So, you know, if you look at an app like Microsoft Word on Windows, like, what's the story there? I mean, it's there isn't one because it's been lost, right? The through line of that application has been completely lost over many, many generations of the software. And that's why when something like Pages comes in from Apple and it's got this clear, this very clear, concise story, it's so wonderful. And you're like, I can't wait to start using that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's refreshing, exactly. And I think part of the way that Apple is so good at this is that they actually formalize the process of telling the story into something called an application definition statement. This might be sort of boring for people who aren't software developers, but
no, I'm highly intrigued, and okay, so are my listeners.
So there's a document, sort of like called writing your first iOS application or something like that in the Apple Developer Library, and it tells you before you start designing, before you start developing, write an application definition statement. And they even sort of hint in the document, like, I know you're not going to want to do this. This may seem like extra work. It's not. This is actually fundamental. You have to do this. Otherwise, your application will not be good. And essentially, you write, you know, sort of like a one sentence, maybe can expand out to a couple sentences if it's a really complex app. And they go through case studies in the human interface guidelines of like what the application definition statement for the Photos app on iPhone was. You know, like how they took the application definition statement from iPhoto on the desktop and they funnel it down to the Photos app and what came out and how that affected the design of the application. So, if you're really interested in that, I would definitely recommend reading these documents because that's really inspired me a lot in the software that I developed to think about it, you know, as a one sentence pitch or story, and then every decision has to get filtered through that.
Yeah. Well, and it becomes clear that Apple would be doing such a thing. Not only, you know, there. So it doesn't surprise me, but also one thing that I've noticed about their iOS advertising, especially with the iPad, is that it's one of the few examples that I see regularly where they answer the question of why.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just that they show the how. Or the what.
Yeah.
Or the where. But they show the why. And it is only from the why that an emotional response can be had.
Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely.
The why is where you get it. Where it's like, oh, this is for reading my morning paper. And my books. And to exchange emails.
Right.
Or, oh, this is where I play games with my kids and then allow them to communicate with grandma.
Because it makes my life easier. Right? Because it makes this more frictionless, or because
yes.
You know, they give you that like that sort of explanation of, well, why should I even pay attention to this? Why should I spend the time? Why should I go out to an Apple store and pick this device up? Because this is actually going to make your life better.
Yeah. Right? It's not only going to make your life better, but here's the story of how. You know, here's the story of why. Right, and we're going to tell you this story, and we've got 30 seconds to do it. And in this 30 seconds is going to be most likely what we wrote down that one sentence on before we even started developing this thing.
Yeah, and see, right? I don't know if either of you have watched the Windows 8 you know, designing great Metro apps video, the 8 traits of Metro apps video. You have?
Yeah,
we were talking about it, weren't we? Because you pointed the Higg to me.
Right. Yeah, we were on Twitter, and you know, while I think that Microsoft in the Metro user interface has done a lot to correct sort of what I was talking about with Word in the past, that this lack of focus, I think that they're still missing that emotional part. I think that they've done a lot of user research on like, okay, well, people can't reach this certain part of the screen, so we're going to make it so that that's not a problem. And they've got the interaction design right, but they don't have the full breadth of the emotion and the storytelling right.
Mm. Yeah, I agree.
They might get there. I'm not saying they can't get there, but...
Yeah. Well, and I would say that getting there is crucial to the survival, right? I mean, I really do think that the applications and the products and you know, that these things that are successful in large part because the story is compelling. Because the story is not only compelling, but it's told, and it's told simply, and it's told well.
Mm-hmm.
And that you don't have to think too hard, you don't have to look too close to understand it's the story.
What do you think, Pat, about characters coming into this. So, for instance, MailChimp.com, which is, I'm thinking about them because we just used it to send out an email to the QuoteBook beta testers. But they have this sort of mascot. Their software mm-hmm. has a mascot. And I think, and they use it all throughout the user interface, all throughout the software to remind you to sort of, I'm going to say humanize, but it's actually a chimp. So, to make it more fun, whimsical. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it sort of fulfills the same function that Flickr did by saying hello to you in a different language every day. It makes it feel more real and less like just like pixels on a screen, like flashing lights. It's like, okay, something's actually happening here.
Yeah.
You know, there's this little chimp following me around, make sure I send my mail out correctly. That's kind of cool. what do you think about that and how that can be brought in?
Well, and I think it's, you know, I think things like that, when done well, are great.
And when done badly, they're Bonsai Buddy, right?
Or Clippy.
Well, yeah, or Clippy, right? Yeah. Right, you know? Right, you know? Yeah, that, that when you bring characters in to this story, as we're calling it, you're walking this very fine line mm-hmm. that could go, you can trip on this line and fall across it at various points. You can do so because it's too cutesy. You could do mm-hmm. so because it's too helpful. You could do so because it's not cutesy enough. It's kind of scary. You could do it because, right. you know, because it's popping up in places that don't make sense.
Right. I think ideally you want to be the character. You and the software are the two sort of characters interacting, and to add a third is sort of can be really dangerous.
Yeah.
Like when I'm talking to my iPhone in voice control, I'm not thinking about the woman that's saying, please say a name, you know. I'm just thinking about the iPhone and me. Mm-hmm. I don't want to see that person's face suddenly. You know?
Well, and how would it change if they did hire some attractive, piece of stock art to be that, you know, that female character talking?
Then I'd be building an emotional connection with that and not with the right. device and the software directly.
Exactly.
And that
yeah.
it's an a layer whole of abstraction. Load of problems.
Yes. Yes. Oh, well, definitely.
Yeah. Well, and a whole load of world of problems for, as well. I think when the other risk you run when doing something like that is the default. Choosing the default then becomes all that much more important, right?
Right.
Because, right. you know, while, you know, some people may be, maybe attracted to, you know, for lack of a better word, some, you know, piece of, you know, female stock art as a default, other people may be put off by it or even offended by it, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I think this gets to the matter of, like, you know, like you said, choosing the default. That's why so many icons are blue, because it's just sort of like a universally pleasing color, and nobody's mm-hmm. like, oh, I hate blue,
mm-hmm.
right? A lot of people hate yellow. A lot of people hate orange. So mm-hmm. you don't see all these icons on your dock that are orange and yellow.
Mm-hmm.
But it leads to a sort of sameness and a lack of character if you go too far in that direction.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like Ollie, the Twitterific bird, for example, is something with character.
That's a character, exactly.
Yeah,
and people identify with that. People buy the plushies. I mean, that's Ollie's a well loved character.
Yeah, also a well stolen character, right?
Oh,
I see Ollie on all sorts of things that have nothing to do with Twitterific, right? And I know for a fact that Twitterific is not licensed in any way, shape, or form, you know?
And one of the biggest ones that I never hear talked about, but I think about constantly, is the Finder icon, right?
Yeah.
It's just there smiling at me all the time. It's the only sort of default anthropomorphic thing on my Mac. It's the only thing that looks human at all.
Yeah.
It's weird that they've kept it looking like that for
this
amount of time.
It is strange.
Because it does not really fit with the aesthetic of the OS anymore.
Right, but what else could it be?
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, so, and maybe that's the reason why it has stuck around, right? Because, I mean, to change it at this point after, I mean, how long has it been around? Since, what, System 4? System 5?
Yeah.
I mean, it's been for a very, very long, long time. So I want to get back to just real briefly, the Microsoft. See, I'm old enough to remember where that tipping point was, where I feel that tipping point was, right? And I think that those that have used and been aware of Word, used the Mac for a very long time, would probably agree with me. Word 5.1 is still, in my opinion, the best word processor ever made. And I think that's largely because you understood its story immediately and you were delighted by the little mini stories it told that no one else has done in a word processor since. Mm-hmm. For instance, you're familiar with Solver, right?
Absolutely.
The Mac app and the iOS app where, it's almost like, having a blank sheet of paper where you can kind of write out math.
It's like having a blank sheet of paper that can actually do math.
Yes. Yes. It was like having a blank sheet of paper that can actually do math.
That's free, by the way. If they want to take that as their slogan, it's free.
Yeah. Yeah, they should. they really should. Word 5.1 could do that.
Yeah.
And then it disappeared. It disappeared after that. It appeared in one version of Word and then poof, gone. Right? But that was one of those things that you just kind of stumble upon. You're like, oh wait, I can just type out a whole bunch of numbers and draw an underline under them and it will add them.
Wow, yeah, that's so far from what Word is now. I mean, that's
but exactly, you get what I'm saying, right?
Well, one of those happened to me in Pages the other day because I inserted the date, right, on a document.
Uh-huh.
And then I came back to it a couple days later to make a new document, from that document, but I didn't save it as a template or anything. I had the date in the footer. I was like, oh, you know what? That date's wrong. I'm going to change that. I was about to delete it. And then Pages came up, oh, do you want to set that to today? What, like, whoa. Wait a minute.
Are you reading my mind?
Yeah, I actually do want to set that today. And it pops up a little calendar interface and stuff like that. And it's like stuff like that, man. Oh, living in the future.
Yeah. Well, and what is interesting about it is that, yes, living in the future, but should be that easy.
Yes, absolutely.
Right? That's why computers exist. Right? Do it like that.
Sorry, Pat, we lost you there a second, mate. Can you just repeat that?
Yeah, I said the reason that we created it was to do this. And I think that in itself is a story, an important one. And the more that we understand these stories and the more that we pay attention to them, the better choices we can make about the software that we choose to use and the software that we choose not to use, and the reason why.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, thanks for talking with me about this. Before, we let you kind of roll here, I wanted to find out. So, you QuoteBook. There's still active development going on there.
Every day, man. Every day.
Despite your full time job, you're still slaving away on that thing.
I wouldn't say despite it. I certainly have taken way less of a role. So I want to absolutely thank the other two developers, Brian Capps, who's on Twitter at Brian Hacks, HAX, and also Andrew Harrison. He's my sort of college roommate, also a developer at Lickability. They've really picked up the pace, and I mean we are happy to announce that our iPad app is almost done. It's coming soon to an app store near you, so we're really excited about that. We should have a couple couple of final things to finish up, some polish, and then also we have to get the syncing done. But just to let everyone know, it will be universal. So if you buy QuoteBook now for your iPhone for $199, you'll get the iPad app for free as well when it comes out.
Great move.
Yeah. Really great move.
And I mean, QuoteBook is one of those apps that I'm very passionate about, and I think that we have done a really good job at building the story for it. It's very simple. It's a notebook for your quotes, and it doesn't come with any quotes built in because we think that you should be finding those throughout your life, not just stumbling upon a huge, book of quotes that you don't even care about, right? It's just more stuff to look through, more stuff to search through and sort through. We think that you should be discovering them.
Yeah. And be intentional about what you put in there and what you choose not to.
Exactly. And that's how we use it. And I mean, I use it constantly.
Yeah. I can't. I know we talked about this on a full episode before, but I get so excited about this app that I have to, I have to constantly say it. It's wonderful. It is just a wonderful app that, Its story is so clear, its purpose so perfected that it's a joy to use at every turn. I got to tell you, my jaw still drops every time I copy a quote out of, say go to, I'm in Twitterific and I copy this tweet. I open up QuoteBook and it pops up that little window that says, oh, we've detected this might be a quote. Do you want to add this?
Right.
You click OK, and it gets the quote in the right place, and it gets the author in the right place, and it gets most of the time, not all the time, but most of the time, the source in the right place if that's included in the copy.
Yeah, yeah. It's
blown away every single time. It never ceases to amaze me. I'm like, oh, I know this one's going to screw it up. I know this one's going to mess with it. Never does.
Well, thanks a lot, Pat. I really appreciate that.
You're welcome. You're welcome. So, I know you can't give us any real big sneak peeks on what's coming up.
Well, if you actually check out my Dribbble profile, which I'm sure you'll link in the show notes, but it's dribbble.com/MB, you can see a quick, cropped screenshot of what QuoteBook for iPad is going to look like. It is a radical departure in terms of our visual design, and we're hoping to bring some of those visual cues back to the iPhone app soon. So
very clear.
Excellent.
Yeah. Very. Well, thank you so much for being on. I really appreciate it, and really nice hearing from a developer about this.
Absolutely. It was great talking
story
about
idea. So, all right. And Michael, as always, thanks a lot for Michael arranges our guests actually being here. I have nothing to do with that. He's the one who does all the hard work. So when someone wants to be on the show, they ask me, I say, okay, talk to Michael.
And then so I'd slave away to meet his demands.
No, I really, really, because it allows me to be the hermit that I am. So, all right. Well, you guys, we'll talk later. All right.
Yeah. Take care. Cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers.